Thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me here. It's by coincidence actually that I'm also here for another kind of workshop on quantum information theory. And people in quantum information theory are obviously very interested in entanglement and trying to understand the consequences of entanglement. And this is also my background. And so I'm kind of a strange person, I think, in this whole conference. I'm probably the one that has understood least of all the talks. And I was actually here in a conference 10 years ago and on quantum information. And I remember that almost all talks were blackboard talks. And I found this kind of absolutely amazing. And I thought, when I come here later, then I will give a blackboard talk. And that's what I will do. I only have two slides. So I will give a blackboard talk on trying to understand or to convey basically how do people in quantum information theory kind of understand correlations in quantum many-body systems. Okay, what does it mean? What does holography for us mean? Or how do we understand this in our naivety? Because we are all very naive. But anyway, we are trying to understand, and I think somehow we have a complementary point of view on what all of you high energy people have. So this is where the work that we'll talk about is in collaboration with Ignacio Sirac from Max Planck Institute. Somehow it's already a long, long time that we work on this. More recently, Norbert Schuch and Didier Poirblanc also kind of joined, and the references of the papers that I will talk about are those. So this is the only slide that I have. Okay, so it's a quote of Feynman that he gave in a conference. There was a conference on variational methods of quantum field theory in 88. And basically he summed up lots and lots of reasons why the variational method cannot work, why somehow it's completely useless to try to think even about variational methods in quantum field theory. But then after this talk, somebody asked, do you really believe what you said? And then he said actually that it's that actually he believes that it should be possible. So let me kind of quickly read it. So it's really quite insane, actually. We are trying to find the energy by taking the expectation of an operator which is located here, and we present ourselves with a functional which is dependent on everything all over the map. That's something wrong. Maybe there is some way to surround the object or the region where we want to calculate things by a surface and describe what things are coming in across the surface. It tells us everything that's going on outside. I'm talking about a new kind of idea, but that's the kind of stuff we shouldn't talk about at the talk. That's the stuff you should actually do. So this is exactly kind of the question that we asked ourselves in quantum information. We have a quantum many-body system. Okay, I have a big system with many degrees of freedom, but you're at the end interested in somehow local correlation functions like the energy and things like that. So what do you need somehow? What is the influence of the outside degrees of freedom that you need to kind of get to describe somehow what is going in? Okay, and it's very clear that this has lots of this is exactly kind of the question of what is the entanglement of your system with the environment or with the outside region. The question I want to address in this talk is exactly the question that he asked. Where are these degrees of freedom? Okay, how can we describe this? How can we locate the degrees of freedom of a system when somehow you have a strongly correlated system of somehow a system A with B? Where are these degrees of freedom that are entangled? Can we kind of identify them? Can we define the Hilbert space on them? And that's what I want to do. And that's actually the end of my presentation. Okay, so let me... Can this actually be... Okay, so the idea is to have a block A and B is the outside. Again, we are dealing with a strongly correlated system, and we would like to understand somehow what is the influence, what degrees of freedom of B are relevant for describing what is going on in A. Okay, you already kind of feel that entanglement entropy is exactly kind of counting how many degrees, but we want to do more than just counting the number of degrees of freedom. We want to identify them. We want to kind of find out where are these. Okay. So you also want to understand, so in principle, so at the end what we want to do is to understand somehow basically the entanglement structure of the wave functions that occur in such systems. Okay, so the setting that we will describe is actually pretty limited. It will be quantum spin systems. Okay, so what is the simplest kind of quantum spin system that we will kind of consider is something like a Heisenberg model. So I guess you are all familiar with the Heisenberg model. Okay, so what happens is that you have a lattice. Okay, it doesn't matter in what dimensions. So my talk will be mostly concerned with two-dimensional lattices, actually. And on every vertex, you have a spin sitting. This could be a spin 1/2. Let's, for simplicity, take a spin 1/2. And we have a Hamiltonian that is local. This is extremely important that it's local, that couples all nearest neighbor spins. Okay, so that means that you have an antiferromagnetic interaction here, 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 between all possible nearest neighbor spins. And what we are interested in is the ground state physics. Okay, so this is very important. So we are really interested only in the low energy physics. Okay, so I think this is, this makes it certainly already different than somehow the most of the talks that we have heard here. I guess somehow this ADS-CFT kind of formalism should be valid for all energy scales. Somehow what we want to do is only kind of look at the low energy scale, especially like the ground states. What can we say about ground states of such systems? How does the entanglement structure look like? And we want to do it. Okay, so low energy is a crucial kind of thing, but we also want to do it in real space. Okay, because we are indeed interested in strongly correlated systems. For strongly correlated systems where interactions are very important, where local interactions are very important, somehow it's much more natural to work in real space than in momentum space. Okay, because that's actually, you do perturbation theory, you would start from your local interactions, but somehow it's exactly this which makes it difficult to use the standard kind of field theory techniques to tackle these problems. Also somehow the area laws and somehow this entanglement entropy that we talk about is always kind of is the most useful in real space. Somehow in momentum space, somehow it's very unclear what it means to kind of define an area law and things like that. Okay, so the first thing that is actually amazing is that if you look at spin systems, you can immediately say something about the entanglement entropy of a region if you kind of look at something like thermal states. Okay, so we take a thermal state at low temperature. So let's take a Gibbs state, beta H. And this H, this Hamiltonian, is, let's say, a local Hamiltonian. This is crucial. Okay, so it only couples. So this Hamiltonian only couples kind of spins that are close to each other. They might, of course, you might have terms that kind of decay, but they have to decay fast enough. Okay, otherwise, somehow, this whole language of the whole kind of formalism that I talk about would not make any sense. And what you can say about any thermal state, the first thing you can say is that actually there will be something like an area law that this satisfies. Okay, so take this e to the minus beta h, with h defined on your whole lattice, and single out a region A in that lattice. And what you want to calculate is actually not the entanglement entropy, but the mutual information. Okay, so what does that mean? So you have your region A, you have your region B. Okay, so what is it that basically counts the number of correlations or the kind of non-trivial correlations between somehow A and B? This is the entropy of A plus the entropy of B minus the entropy of A, B. So you can immediately check, so this is called the mutual information of A, B. You can immediately check that if you have a pure state, if the global state is pure, this reduces to 2 times the entanglement entropy, okay? Because the entropy of the global state is 0. And if you have a pure state, then the entanglement entropy of A is equal to the entanglement entropy of B. And therefore, this kind of reduces to this. Again, there's actually a very neat proof, and that's why it's really a two-line proof of this fact that any state, any kind of state that is thermal or close to ground state actually will obey something like an area law. That means that there's very few degrees of freedom that matter. Okay, this proof goes via some kind of, there's a paper that we wrote together with Matthew Hastings a few years ago, and it's by invoking the idea of the free energy. So what is so special to these thermal states, what is special to somehow a Gibbs state, is that this is the state that that minimizes the free energy over all possible states. Okay, so that means that this state, okay, let's call it rho AB, is the one that minimizes the trace of H times rho minus temperature times the entropy of rho AB. So the Gibbs state is by somehow construction, you can easily find this by Lagrange constraint, is the state that minimizes the free energy over all possible states. So that means that if you would take any other trial state, take any density matrix that is defined on your kind of Hilbert space, then that it would have a free energy that is larger. Okay, so let's take as a trial state, actually take the marginals of this state. So we take rho A tensor rho B. Okay, so that means take the marginal of state rho A, of rho AB on A, put it there, take the marginal of rho AB on B and put it there. Okay, we know that the free energy of that state is necessarily larger than the free energy of that state. Okay, but what is the free energy of that state? It's a trace of H times rho A tensor rho B minus T times. Somehow the entropy of a tensor product is additive. Okay, so this means that this is the entropy of rho A plus the entropy of rho B. And we know that this thing is smaller than this. Now what you see is indeed, what you get here is exactly this mutual information. You get SA plus SB minus SAB. And what you get here is the energy of these two things. But what you see is that the energy, so your Hamiltonian is local. Therefore, the only terms where this expectation value will differ from this expectation value are the values, the terms in your Hamiltonian that act on the border. All the other terms, of course, will give exactly the same expectation value for this and for this. And therefore, the difference of these two has to be something that scales like somehow the boundary of your region A. And this immediately kind of proves that the mutual information, okay, so the amount of kind of correlations between A and B is bounded by something that scales like the boundary and not like the volume. Okay, that means that there's very few degrees of freedom there that should matter. Okay, so actually this is, of course you could object that this proof kind of breaks down when temperature goes to zero, and that's indeed true, because you have this T in front here, and when temperature goes to zero, you see that this proof breaks down. And then it's much more complicated to actually come up with similar similar statements. But it's mainly Matthew Hastings. Well, let me write his name. Matthew Hastings, who is in Microsoft right now, came up with actually a fantastic formalism using Leap-Robinson bounds to also prove to make statements like that at zero temperature. So it happens that actually also when the temperature goes to zero and modulo some kind of assumptions on the density of states and so further, that somehow the entropy of, if you have a many-body system and you look at the ground state and actually the mutual information or somehow the entanglement entropy will be bounded by something that scales like the area. Okay, this is, for ground states, this is only true when you have gapped systems. Okay, so you must have a gap in the system, and this is, we will mainly interested with systems that are gapped. Okay, so we think, so for systems that are not gapped, actually I refer to the next talk by Brian Swingle. He will certainly kind of talk a lot about critical systems, and also there somehow this whole formalism about area laws actually makes still lots of sense. But I will kind of focus in this talk on gapped system. So what are these Leap-Robinson bounds? These Leap-Robinson bounds are actually something that were discovered a long time ago by Leap and Robinson, but nobody paid attention to it until Hastings realized that you can actually use them for. So Leap-Robinson bounds kind of have to do with effective light cones. So you know that in the relativistic systems, of course, there's a light cone. Okay, you cannot kind of signal, you cannot propagate information faster than the speed of light. So what happens in non-relativistic systems is that if you kind of do something in your system, then somehow there's still an effective light cone given by some kind of velocity of your quasi-particles. And beyond this kind of light cone, you have exponential decaying tails. Okay, so what that means is that actually all the physics that kind of follows from the fact that you have light cones in non- and relativistic systems, you can kind of take them over, modulo these exponential tails, and make lots of statements like this area law. So in relativistic systems, it's very easy to prove these area laws using this kind of strong superrelativity proofs. Well, you have to kind of work much harder, but at the end, it's a very similar kind of thing to do for non-relativistic systems, where you have to take into account these exponential tails, and then somehow you can do that. But Matthew Hastings is the one who really pioneered this and kind of made fantastic contributions there. Okay, so what does that mean now for, let's say, our two-dimensional theory? Okay, so it means that we have our big lattice with all our spins. And by the way, please ask me questions if I'm going too slow or too fast or some questions. So what it means is that if you kind of look at this two-dimensional system, okay, and you would like to describe the physics that is going on in this region, that we would like to come up with an effective one-dimensional theory that kind of describes the effect of the outside to this, because this matches the degrees of freedom. Okay, so if the entanglement entropy of this region somehow scales like the border, it means that somehow the effective Hilbert space that you need somehow to describe the outside must scale like somehow the border of your system, and therefore there must be kind of corresponds. This must correspond to a one-dimensional system. Okay, so what is this? Where are these degrees of freedom? How can we kind of get hold of those degrees of freedom? So again, somehow, just to stress, because I mean, for me this is obvious, but probably not for everybody in the audience. We are really concerned with spin systems. Okay, that the local dimension of your Hilbert space is kind of bounded. Okay, so if you kind of would like to kind of come up with arguments like the ones I make for field theories, it would be much harder because somehow you have unbounded operators. You would have to kind of introduce cutoffs. I'm not so sure somehow how much of what I say kind of would carry over to systems that. That have unbounded kind of local Hilbert spaces. Anyway, so let's step back and kind of consider again this Heisenberg model. Okay, so let's try to get some intuition of why is it, or what how do the ground states of such systems look like? What are the properties of the wave functions that describe the low energy physics of this? Okay, so if you have this Heisenberg Hamiltonian Si times Sj. Okay, so if you just look at this as a 4x4 matrix acting on two spins. Okay, then we know that, of course, this is kind of you have a singlet that has the lowest energy, and you have the triplet that has a larger energy. Okay, so what this means is that on this lattice, what you would ideally want, okay, is to have a situation where every kind of, between every links, there is a singlet. Okay, so you have a singlet between these two, but you also have a singlet between these two, you have a singlet between these two, you have a singlet between, so you have singlets everywhere. Okay, so this would certainly be the ground state if it would kind of be possible to get such a state. But what there is something in entanglement theory that clearly prevents somehow a state such a state to be physical. What it means, because somehow if I have a spin 1/2 here, okay, this thing is a spin 1/2. If it's in a maximally entangled state, because a singlet is maximally entangled, so the singlet is just spin up down. Minus down up, 1/2. So this is a maximally entangled state in the language of quantum information theory. And if you have a spin 1/2, this is a physical system that is maximally entangled with somehow its left or its right. If it's maximally entangled with something, it cannot be entangled at all anymore with all the rest. Okay, so it means that this is called the monogamy property of entanglement. Okay, so actually this concept of monogamy of entanglement kind of was discovered long time ago in quantum information theory and became very popular recently in the discussions of these kind of firewalls. This is actually the same principle, that if somehow you are very much entangled with something, then you cannot be entangled with anything else anymore. Okay, so you see that indeed this is kind of what makes the physics so interesting of such systems. It's exactly this monogamy, that somehow I would like to have a singlet here, I would like to have a singlet here, but this kind of cannot be. There's some frustration there. So how do you reconcile that? How do you kind of get over that? So it means that actually so there's a competition between somehow having singlets everywhere and having a symmetry in your system, namely the translation invariant symmetry. So you want your system to be translation invariant, but nevertheless you want to have singlets everywhere. So what it means is that actually the ground state is such that you would like to maximize the local correlations, because the energy of your system is only dependent on your kind of correlation. So you would like to kind of maximize the local correlations given the symmetries in the symmetries in your system. And actually, so what this means is that you want to kind of reduce density matrices of your ground states must be extremal points in all possible and in somehow the space of all possible reduced density matrices. Okay, because that is just a function of this reduced density matrix. And if you're a ground state, it must be an extreme point. So you're interested in kind of characterizing the extreme points of this set. And actually, in 3 weeks' time, there's another conference here in the Newton Institute, which is exactly about this, about kind of quantum marginals. This is called the marginal problem. How can I characterize marginals or extreme points of marginals of quantum many-body systems? Okay. Anyway, so what is the resolution of kind of this competition between these two? So this is so we came up with some kind of so we were extremely inspired by a paper of Affleck, Kennedy, Leap. So the name Leap appears everywhere, and Tazaki. Okay, so this is also called AKLT. So what they kind of realized is that for one particular model, you could kind of find an exact ground state wave function by saying, well, I have singlets indeed, because these singlets kind of give me these strong correlations, but my physical Hilbert space, the Hilbert space that actually is physical, is like a subspace of all these kind of virtual singlets. So in this kind of spin 1/2 case, you would kind of start with singlets between all kind of shared between all your neighbors, but then you would have a map. Okay, this map would map a 2-to-4-dimensional system to a 2-dimensional system, and this would be a linear map. Okay, and this is exactly so. They didn't do it in general. They kind of looked at one example, but it's clear that somehow this is a completely generic construction. You can start from kind of actually lots of entanglement between nearest neighbors, and then get your kind of symmetry, your translational symmetry, by saying actually my physical system lives on a subspace of these several virtual particles. So it's in some sense it's a bit, could imagine a bit this like a picture of quarks. So you have like underlying quarks that are kind of entangled with your kind of neighbors, but your physical subspace, the space that you can actually access, that they can see, is just a subspace of this space of 4 underlying degrees of freedom. Okay, so this is the construction. This is called somehow this construction projected entangled pair states for obvious reasons. Projected entangled pair. Okay, so see, this way you have your kind of locality, you have your strong correlations, and of course you have your translation invariance for free if you put the same projector everywhere. Okay, so this is the way to create states that have translation invariance and very strong local correlations. Okay, and what is somehow the definition now of these states? All the states somehow the variation. So at the end this will become some kind of a manifold. You can prove that actually these states form a manifold, and this manifold has a number of parameters that is related to how many different maps are there to map these kind of 4 virtual spins to 1 physical spin. At the end this is just a linear, this is just a matrix. So if your kind of underlying spins have dimension d and your physical dimension is small d, then somehow in this particular case of a square lattice you would have d times d to the 4 degrees of freedom. Okay, so this would be kind of the dimension, the number of parameters that you have within this class of states. Actually this is an overcounting, because there's some kind of gauge degrees of freedom, and actually it's not really somehow so you cannot just do it, use the normal manifold. You have, it's a fiber bundle, because somehow of these gauge degrees of freedom you have to kind of gauge out these things. But anyway, so you can do all of this, and it gives a very nice mathematical formula. Yes?
Map between the virtual spins and the real spins, which is a model dependent.
Of course. So this is just a generic picture of how to construct states that are very strong, that have very strong local correlations, but are nevertheless kind of translation invariant. Okay, this is actually the only construction like that I know that have this both of these features. And indeed, you can actually prove that this is again using these Leib-Robinson bounds, and this is actually very much inspired by the work of Matthew Hastings. You can prove that any state that kind of obeys this area laws and is the Hamiltonian, which is the ground state of a local Hamiltonian, actually has a very efficient representation like this. Okay, so what this actually means is that this set of PEPs, or in one dimension actually these are called matrix product states, they basically parameterize the ground state manifold of any kind of local Hamiltonian. Okay, so you have your humongous Hilbert space. Okay, that if you have n spins, the dimension of the Hilbert space is 2 to the n. Okay, there's a tiny corner here. Okay, and in this tiny corner are all the ground states of local Hamiltonians, because it's obvious there's not many local Hamiltonians. The number of parameters that you need to describe local Hamiltonians just scales. It's very few, and there's very few parameters by which you can, depends on how kind of local they are. But somehow these states actually kind of parameterize this manifold of low energy states. So the low energy states of any local Hamiltonian can effectively are all like that. Okay, so let's try to understand the features now of these states. That's what I this approximates the ground state. Okay, so of course it's not exactly the ground state, but somehow you can prove that to get somehow a fidelity, to get an overlap that is 1 minus epsilon with the true ground state, the question is then what is the dimension. So it's clear that you can arbitrarily kind of increase this class of variational wave functions by, instead of working with kind of singlets between spin 1/2 particles, you just work with maximally entangled states. Sorry, I should have kind of said this, between I is equal to 1 and d i. Okay, so by enlarging the Hilbert space of these virtual particles, you kind of course enlarge the variational class, okay, because there's more and more and more maps. Okay, and the question is, so when I say it's efficient, then it means that how large has this d to be to get an overlap with the exact ground state that is 1 minus epsilon. And then you can prove that actually this d has to scale polynomially in 1 over epsilon. Okay, so that means that indeed you have an extreme reduction. You start with an exponentially large Hilbert space, but all the states that are relevant for you can actually be described by a polynomial number of parameters. Okay, and I don't have time to kind of explain all the details, but that's the spirit. Kind of, you want to understand ground states of local gapped Hamiltonians, then it's enough to basically look at this class of wave functions. Okay, so let's see that whether this indeed kind of makes sense in the light of this area laws. Okay, so how can we kind of see that indeed these states obey an area law? Okay, so let's imagine, so let me kind of draw this state again, and let's calculate the entanglement entropy for such a state. Okay, so I would have my singlet. Well, I should have done that beforehand, but anyway. So let's calculate the entanglement entropy of like a region like this. So actually, an upper bound for the entanglement entropy of a region is, of course, the rank of your is the log of the rank of your density matrix. Okay, so that means that if you trace out all the outside degrees of freedom, you get a reduced density matrix in the middle, and every singlet or every kind of maximally entangled state that you trace out, somehow you increase the rank of that reduced density matrix with a factor of d. Okay, and the total number of kind of maximally entangled states that you trace out, that you kind of trace out in some sense, somehow it scales like the size of this block, and therefore you automatically have the area law. So you see that indeed these states by construction obey the area law, but they can also not have more entanglement than that. Okay, you cannot have kind of peps that have more entanglement than somehow what is required for your area laws. Okay, so this is a good thing, but what I want to kind of go next is I want to kind of specialize a little bit. I want to kind of talk about symmetries, about topological order, about these kind of things. So what are these features? How will this affect these kind of properties of your state? Okay, so actually one thing that I forgot to say is that it goes vice versa. So how ground states of local Hamiltonians can be well approximated by those states. But for any of those states, you can actually find a local Hamiltonian for which this is the exact ground state. Okay, so this is, and this has to do exactly with this feature that the reduced density matrix of a region, somehow the rank of that reduced density matrix only scales like somehow the product of all the bonds that you cut. So it scales like some, so if you kind of look at the rank of this density matrix, it's certainly upper bounded by d to the l, with l somehow the length of the border. What is the dimension on which somehow this reduced density matrix lives? It's this small d, but this scales like L squared, okay? Because this is the volume. This is the Hilbert space on which somehow you have all these kind of projectors here. But the Hilbert space on which all these spins live has dimension d to the L squared, because you just count the number of physical kind of states, and this is this. So you see that when L becomes large enough, this will certainly be larger than this, okay? So there will always be an L such that this becomes larger than this. And then actually the Hamiltonian for which this is the exact ground state would be somehow the projector on the space orthogonal to this subspace that is d to the l dimensional. So you can always find exact Hamiltonians for which these are ground states. And these are actually very special Hamiltonians. They are frustration free and they have lots of properties. Okay, so so you already kind of start feeling that the very first question, the question that somehow I asked after kind of seeing this slide of Feynman, where are these degrees of freedom? You already start seeing that actually these virtual degrees of freedom might just be more than just some kind of a calculational tool or some kind of a thing. Maybe these are the degrees of freedom. So maybe my one-dimensional theory that kind of will describe the physics of my outside region will just be a Hamiltonian that is defined on these kind of links that kick out or that kind of stick out of your system. And indeed, this is exactly what happens. Okay, so what you will see is that if you want to describe somehow your so you want to describe basically the physics of the outside to the inside, you will get effectively local Hamiltonians that are defined on these virtual degrees of freedom, on these quad degrees of freedom that actually you cannot see physically. Okay, so they are kind of hidden. Okay, so I should have more here, but somehow they are hidden inside. Somehow they are kind of hidden. They are kind of virtual degrees of freedom. Okay, and there has been lots and lots of interest in recent years about systems that exhibit topological quantum order. Okay, so this is especially the Alexei Kitaev who kind of initiated this whole research program. And actually, this will manifest itself in symmetries of these tensors. And this is one of the things that I want to talk about now. Okay, so. Okay, so what have we learned? That there is actually some kind of a local description of your many-body wave functions, okay, even for strongly correlated systems. And this local description is given by these tensors. So in some sense, these tensors themselves, these maps that map your virtual system to your physical system, they will start playing the role of your order parameter. Okay, so that means that you say I have a certain Hamiltonian, but it has a ground state. Well, instead of kind of looking at, if you're interested in the properties, the low energy properties, it will be enough to study basically the properties of these tensors. Okay, these tensors will kind of play the role of some kind of an order parameter. Indeed, we'll see that even global properties like what kind of topological order do we have? What is the kind of nature of what are the symmetries in the system? All of this is reflected in this one tensor. So this is just one matrix that tells you how to map these virtual degrees of freedom to the physical one. This contains all the information that you need to know of what happens. And if you want to kind of know what the outside is to the inside, this will be kind of an effective one-dimensional Hamiltonian on these virtual links. Okay, so let me first kind of say something about symmetries, because at the end I also want to talk about topological order. Okay, so what happens if you have symmetries in your system? For example, your system is SU2 invariant. Okay, so if your system is SU2 invariant, actually this can be very easily accommodated by such kind of states, by this class of states. So what happens is that, so you see somehow this, we have this. Okay, and here you have this physical degree of freedom sticking out. Okay, so what I'm drawing here are tensor networks. So if you want that this system is SU2 invariant. Okay, so it means that if I put any unitary here on the physical kind of level, okay, if this is equal to something like this, and now you will immediately see that somehow this has to do with the gauge degrees of freedom. If I kind of find a V dagger and a W dagger, where V and W are kind of unitaries or kind of representation of the same kind of group as U, that if you work with a U, you act with a U on the physical system, if this is equivalent to somehow acting with a V and a V dagger on the virtual system, then obviously your whole system will have the symmetry, okay? Because it means that if you put U's everywhere, so you put U's everywhere here on this lattice, somehow you can just pull this kind of U's through, okay? If we can pull this U through, you get the W, W dagger, V, V dagger, and this V dagger from this guy will of course cancel the V here, and the system automatically kind of inherits all the symmetries, okay? So this is actually a very simple type of symmetry, but all these kind of states have it.
V and W are not the same?
Sorry? They don't have to be the same. But it's very interesting it doesn't even have to be like that. It could be a projective representation. Okay, so they don't even have to have the same representation, because you see one U kind of corresponds to a W and a W dagger. So that means that W does not even have to be the same representation as U, it just have to be, it can be a projective representation. And that actually leads to the classification of all phases. So there has been lots of activity in recent years to classify all possible phases of gap, all possible gapped phases, like in one and in two dimension. And this is exactly kind of what is, these kind of things play an extremely important role. What kind of, if I put a U here, what kind of representation do I get here? Do I get the regular, or do I get a projective representation? And somehow, what you can prove is that you will not be able to adiabatically go from one state to another one that has the same symmetry if somehow one corresponds to a different projective representation than the other one. Okay, then you cannot adiabatically go from one to the other one, therefore the gap has to close, and therefore there must be a phase transition, and these things must correspond to different phases. So this is what lots of activity in this kind of community is exactly kind of focused on, trying to understand these things. How can we use this knowledge, now that ground states have this structure, to classify all possible phases of matter? Okay.
So if I want a rotational symmetry between the two directions, then do they have to be the same?
No, they don't have to be the same. There's no reason why. But it could, of course, be the same, no? But there's a priori no reason that this has to be the case. So you could have the symmetry, but it's kind of hidden. Okay, so this is okay. So actually, what is uh, much more interesting is when you have topological order in your system. Okay, so I don't know to what extent somehow this community is familiar with these systems that have topological order, this quantum spin system that exhibit topological order. Okay, so that means that there's somehow there's a very strange entanglement in your system that kind of that such that the ground state degeneracy, for example, is dependent on the genus of the surface on which somehow your system is defined. So if you have your if you have your quantum spin system defined on a torus, then typically you would have, for example, a four-dimensional kind of degeneracy. If it's just defined on a disk, then you have just a unique ground state. So that the ground state degeneracy is kind of related to the to the genus of your system. And it happens that all these kind of toy examples that people have created, like this Levin-Wen model, these Kitaev models, all of this, has an exact representation in terms of these tensor networks. Okay, and what happens is that these tensor networks that describe these topological ordered systems, it means that somehow actually these tensors have another symmetry. There's no U here, but somehow it happens that this is equal to this. Okay, so that there is, for example, for the Kitaev toric code, there's some kind of a z, this poly z operator. You can kind of put this poly z on all the virtual systems, and you see that actually this is completely invariant. So what that means is that actually your virtual degrees of freedom, they must live in a certain subspace. Okay, so your virtual degrees of freedom, they must be such that somehow the parity of all of these virtual degrees of freedom must be even. Okay, so that means that this gives rise to some kind of global constraints. Okay, so and in particular, what it means is that you can start classifying topological order by saying that, indeed, I will just look at tensors that have a special type of symmetries. You can actually kind of do that in terms of some other kind of operators that you kind of, okay, so you would kind of put some other tensor network here. So you kind of define something like this is what we call a matrix product operator. And you will have a system that has topological order if and only if somehow I can pull this string through my lattice. So it means that somehow if I have this blue thing crossing here, I can pull this through. So you see that indeed, if I have a z and a z here and nothing here, this is equivalent to having a z there and a z there because this is symmetry of your system. Okay, so that means that we can start pulling this kind of string through the lattice, and the conditions for which this kind of holds is very similar to these kind of Young-Baxter equations that you have when you solve kind of integral models. It's like there must be some inherent symmetry, and if you kind of do this, or you scatter like this, or you scatter like that, this has to be equal. So all this kind of, this whole language is actually very, very similar to the language that people have been using in the algebraic beta-ansatz for a very long time. Somehow this tensor network business is very, very similar to this. Anyway, so how? There's a very famous formula of Kitaev, Preskill, Levin, and Wen that characterizes the topological quantum entropy if you have topological order. So it means that somehow if you kind of calculate the entanglement entropy of a region, it indeed scales like the area, but you have to subtract a constant. Okay, so how do you see this in this language now? It's exactly that these tensors all have a global constraint, namely the parity of these things has to be conserved. So that means that this link, this blue thing, okay, if you kind of close it, it would exactly count the parity of all these strings that sit out. And this parity has to be even. And that's exactly this constant one that you have to subtract from your entanglement entropy, because it means that actually you don't have all the possible degrees of freedom. You have kind of, there's one qubit, or there's kind of the parity is given. So there's this kind of, your entanglement entropy is one less than you would expect. Okay, and this is, so you can actually all understand this very, very nicely within this language of PEPS. So the one thing that I forgot to mention that is actually very relevant is that this is also leading to new methods of simulating quantum spin systems. So one of the big open problems in condensed matter physics is to really simulate two-dimensional quantum, strongly correlated quantum spin system, like the Hubbert model. Okay, and actually because we know now what is the kind of the nature of these ground states must be very close to this, you can use this as a variational ansatz and start building new computational methods. Actually it's like Steve White invented the kind of dynamic the density matrix normalization group kind of initiated this kind of research a long time ago without kind of realizing that what he is doing is indeed a variational kind of calculation within the class of a one-dimensional version of this kind of PEPS. And this is really the state of the art for simulating quantum spin systems. How much time do I have left? 5 minutes. Okay, so
the only way to impose this kind of
constraint on the link is this is the only way to have topological order using this language, or there may be some...
So we have not a strict proof, but somehow we have very strong evidence, and we are working on that indeed this is... The way to characterize topological order is to kind of define matrix product operators, so other objects that are tensors that you can pull through the lattice. Okay, and the nature of what are these degrees of freedom and somehow what symmetries are those, somehow are in one-to-one correspondence with the nature of the topological order of your kind of state. Okay, so again, somehow what we are talking about here are gapped. In some sense, we are assuming that the bulk is gapped of your system. Okay, and then this is a very good representation. It actually happens that as a variational method, this also works very, very well for gapless systems. But that's another issue. Somehow there, things are much more complicated to actually prove, to prove things. Okay, so this is this this is basically what I the main message of what these symmetries do. So let's try to now understand what this entanglement spectrum does. So instead of the area law, Lee and Haldane had a much more refined way of looking at area laws. They said actually it's not just that if I look at somehow my you have your big system. Okay, so it's not just that your entanglement entropy obeys an area law. There's also an entanglement spectrum. Okay, so it happens that if you kind of write, so this is system A and B, somehow your system psi AB can be written as some square root of lambda I psi IA psi IB. So this is called the Schmidt decomposition. So this is defined on the Hilbert space A, this is defined on the Hilbert space B, this is an orthonormal set, this is orthonormal, this is called also the singular value decomposition. And these are called the Schmidt numbers. These lambda i's are exactly the eigenvalues of your reduced density matrix. And what they kind of realized is that actually these eigenvalues, they look very much like the exponentials of the eigenvalues of a local Hamiltonian. Okay, so it means that actually this kind of rho a, what this means, if this kind of looks like the exponentials of a local Hamiltonian, it means that actually your reduced density matrix rho a looks very much like e to the minus beta h. The spectrum of rho a looks very much like the thermal state. So if you look at the eigenvalues of this operator, it looks very much like the eigenvalues of a thermal state defined on a one-dimensional system, okay, for a two-dimensional case. So this is what they kind of realized, and indeed somehow they had strong evidence with CFTs, and they had a fantastic kind of results where you could show this. But somehow what they did not do is identify where these degrees of freedom live. Okay, where is this one-dimensional system? What does it mean to have somehow the fact that these eigenvalues kind of coincide? So obviously, once you have this formalism of PEPs, it's very clear somehow what the guess would be where these degrees of freedom live. So if you trace out your system, so let's trace out this kind of part of the system. So the only time, the only kind of connection between right and left is by these virtual degrees of freedom. And indeed, you can start writing down now what, if I trace out this kind of system, what are these kind of Schmidt values? And you can effectively kind of trace out everything to the right, everything to the left, and look at what is my theory, effective theory here, on completely defined on my virtual system. Okay, and then you see that actually what you get here on this virtual links, on this Hilbert space that is not physical but is this kind of virtual space, you get that indeed this entanglement spectrum, okay, so are exactly the eigenvalues of a Hamiltonian that is local and which is defined on these kind of quark degrees of freedom. Okay, so it means that indeed these are the degrees of freedom. And now somehow you have to kind of map back due to this kind of mapping between somehow bulk or kind of virtual degrees of freedom and physical degrees of freedom, somehow there's this mapping, you can exactly map back these virtual degrees of freedom to the physical ones by applying these maps. Okay, so we can actually go back and identify exactly, well, these are the degrees of freedom that that matter. Now, these papers that I kind of referenced, that actually there's one of these papers that appeared exactly today on the archive. We exactly kind of asked the question, what happens now if somehow I have an effective, I have a Hamiltonian here on my system, somehow, and I have open boundaries. Okay, what is the effective Hamiltonian? Okay, so there are of course none of these virtual degrees of freedom, but still, if you have a local Hamiltonian, somehow typically somehow the edge will give rise to edge modes. And it happens that even for systems, for generic systems indeed, somehow it happens that you can identify somehow these edge degrees of freedom with these virtual links, and you can define now exactly a local Hamiltonian, one-dimensional Hamiltonian, where all these things live. Now, what is interesting is that whenever you have topological order, that this gives rise to one-dimensional quantum spin systems subject to some kind of global constraints. Okay, so for example, in the case of a toric coat, which is a system of spin 1/2 systems, what is the effective Hamiltonian that you get on the border by kind of looking at somehow what happens on the edge? You get actually a Z2 parity. So this is exactly this parity that I talked about that is preserved. So what you get is exactly somehow a super selection rule on the border. So it obviously is not possible as a one-dimensional. This is not stable. It cannot be stable as a one-dimensional system. So you could never have a one-dimensional quantum spin system with local interactions that would kind of have a super selection rule like Z2 that is completely preserved. Okay, so this is, you could have this with fermions, but not with spin 1/2. So what you see is that actually on the edge of a two-dimensional theory, you can actually have this. And of course, what I'm saying here is just rephrasing what people in condensed matter physics have been known a long time. So it's like if you have kind of a fractional quantum Hall states, then what you get on the border is like the chiral modes. And these chiral modes you cannot get as ground states of one-dimensional quantum spin systems, but nevertheless, somehow they are protect the fact that you get this. This is because they are protected by somehow the topological order and the gap in your system. So the main message that I want to convey is that actually this picture of understanding kind of quantum many body systems and low energy states and ground states in terms of these virtual degrees of freedom, in terms of these tensor networks, is actually very physical. Okay, and leads really to a very kind of precise and clear way of identifying the degrees of freedom. Where is this? So why is it that you have this area laws? Where are these degrees of freedom? Why is it, for example, that if you have topological quantum order, that there's kind of a constant that is subtracted from this entanglement entropy? All these kind of questions. So what we are of course exploring many. We're just beginning to understand somehow how rich this thing is, and we also look at excitations, at kind of quasi particles, at scattering of quasi particles. All of this is kind of very natural within this language, and we hope that we can kind of rediscover many of the things that people already have discovered, but in a much more kind of systematic way and actually a mathematical kind of rigorous way, what people have already been doing in condensed matter physics. So thanks for your attention.
So when you write rho A equal to exponential minus beta H, so that H is in general not localized on the boundary.
Right? Indeed. So a priori there's no reason to even know where these degrees of freedom are. What is even the Hilbert space? What is the Hilbert space of this? So what Haldane kind of realizes indeed that the spectrum of this looks very much like the spectrum of a one-dimensional theory. But somehow he had no way of kind of saying, well, this Hilbert space associated to this one-dimensional system is that Hilbert space. In this language, it's very clear. The Hilbert space is exactly the Hilbert space kind of spanned by all these virtual degrees of freedom.
Yeah, but this is, so that picture is an approximation, or you think it's a...
Well, it's exact if your state is exactly a PEPS. Okay, so if your system is approximated by it, then this is still a very good approximate kind of picture of what is going on in reality. So the thing is that for any gapped system, this is supposedly kind of adiabatically connected to the exact one. Okay, so the idea is that this picture, so this state is in the same phase as the exact one. Okay, so there's some kind of an adiabatic way of going to lifting all these statements that just hold, in fact, true for these PEPS, but it actually holds for every state in that phase. That's.
But can I say that PEPS formulation captures the local part of this exact Hamiltonian?
Yes. Well, you can just give you a Hamiltonian that gives this. You can indeed identify a Hamiltonian defined on these things that would exactly reproduce this. But you don't have to define it. It's just given. It's a function of these tensors. Given these tensors, I can immediately calculate what this Hamiltonian is. And then you can check, and indeed it will match somehow the predictions. So there is.
So is there some understanding on what the entanglement Hamiltonian look like for gapless state?
Well, in.
Yes.
Okay. That's exactly what Brian will talk about, indeed.
I won't talk about it very much, but there is an understanding.
So is it non-local Hamiltonian in general?
It's local, but in the higher dimension. In the same dimension. It's sort of.
You need
the local in A, but not on the boundary.
So the boundary theory is not a local theory.
Yeah. But it's sort of almost local.
So the entanglement entropy is still very much like the area law is kind of still satisfied, okay, for critical systems. So it's not that there's so many more degrees of freedom that you need. Okay, there might be logarithmic corrections, and I guess that's exactly what Brian will kind of also explain.